When we left you last, we were just getting to the part where Sidney Rigdon meets up with the Mormons. In part two, we're going to dive into Sidney's interactions with the Mormons, making a case for his claim to Mormon leadership after Joseph Smith is murdered in Carthage.
If you haven't listened to the previous episode, pause here and go give it a listen. We mentioned last time that there's this theory that Sidney Rigdon helped write the Book of Mormon, though the theory isn't that compelling to me or to Brian. Based on my own conceptions of Rigdon and the timeline, I just don't think it works. But it's still good to familiarize yourself with the controversies that are out there.
We're going to jump back into Sidney's story soon, but first, a minute for our sponsors. Brigham Young had a, shall we say, large personality. It's no surprise then that some of his children did as well. However, none stood out more than Sousa. From her marriage to Alma Dunford at age 16, her life was full of adventure, both the triumphant kind as well as the sorrowful. Occasionally referred to as the 13th Apostle, Sousa Young Gates was at the epicenter of Utah and Mormon happenings. An active voice in the suffragist movement, Sousa was constantly writing in defense of her sisters and her religion. Author Romney Burke has mined Sousa's massive collections of personal papers to finally give her fascinating and complicated life the detailed and probing treatment it deserves. Sousa Young Gates, Daughter of Mormonism by Romney Burke, new from Signature Books, available at Benchmark Books or wherever you get your books.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Sidney Rigdon and his little hippie commune congregation got the Book of Mormon in 1830. Rigdon's initial skepticism melted into surefire testimony of the truthfulness of it all.
Missionaries from New York, Parley Pratt and Oliver Cowdery, were kind of rocking the Kirtland area with their new message. People began flocking to Kirtland to hear this new message. Some came to argue with the missionaries about the theology. Some came to just hear the message. Others came just for the spectacle. In either case, those two alone baptized 127 people.
How much did you guys baptize on your missions? Huh? How many? So some of the people they baptized were right out of Rigdon's Kirtland congregation. So here's a pro tip to missionaries. If you really want to have a successful time, either have your mission in Hawaii in the 1840s or baptize an entire congregation. Rigdon didn't love that at first, but he soon gets baptized by Cowdery and Mormonism hit the ground running in Kirtland. The hippie family had been brought into Mormonism. Most of them. Some members of Rigdon's mentor congregation weren't happy their own minister had jumped ship.
Yeah, his mentor congregation was like, what the heck, dude? We're building you this nice house. You go 3 miles down the road and get baptized somewhere else? Not cool, man. They responded by filling his spot as minister with M.S. Clapp, who was married to Alicia Campbell, who just happened to be the sister of Rigdon's rival, Alexander Campbell. Ouch.
The two very happy missionaries, Cowdery and Pratt, head back to headquarters and leave Rigdon with a congregation in the Book of Mormon. Soon, though, Rigdon would want to meet Joseph Smith, so by the end of 1830, he traveled to Kingdon, near Waterloo, to find the prophet. And when they meet, the prophet greeted him with a revelation. Behold, verily, verily, I say unto my servant Sidney, I have looked upon thee and thy works, I have heard thy prayers, and prepared thee for a great work. Thou art blessed, for thou shalt do great things. Behold, thou wast sent forth, even as John, to prepare the way before me and before Elijah, which should come, and thou knew it not.
If being compared to John the Baptist wasn't enough of an ego boost to Sidney Rigdon, the revelation also encouraged him to help watch over Joseph Smith and help him to be successful. To quote, "Tarry with him, and he shall journey with you. Forsake him not, and surely these things shall be fulfilled. And inasmuch as ye do not write, behold, it shall be given unto him to prophesy, and thou shalt preach my gospel." That sounds like a manual. They should do a manual about that.
Well, the revelation ended with what a good Mormon revelation always ends with, a reminder that Jesus was coming soon. And Rigdon felt the weight and significance of his role in all of this. Imagine the prophet of God telling you that you're going to help usher in the second coming. That's only happened to me once, Brian.
Until now. I mean, there's still time.
For his part, no, they actually really did. I can't say his name on here because he probably listened.
But Sunstone's coming. You can get a second one.
One of the five wives. You know who he is. The guy. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I do.
One of five wives in a man's revelation out there where if I join him, we will help usher in the second coming. So it's no Sidney Rigdon, but kind of special just the same. Anyway, for his part, Joseph Smith was impressed that such a scholarly, classically trained minister would be so taken with Mormonism. He invited Rigdon to help him work on a revision of the Bible. And every time I think about this, I think, that sounds so boring. Why would you want to do that?
Excuse me?
I know, Brian.
This is 1830s sexy. I mean, come on. And let's be honest, revision there might be a strong word. Just like the King James Version was a translation of the Bible, Joseph Smith just kind of wanted his own version of it too. He'd been working on it for 6 months before he met Sidney, and needless to say, Rigdon was very excited for the project. Did you hear that? He was excited.
It's because they didn't have Mario Kart yet.
If they'd had TikTok, Sidney would have just been like doom scrolling like a crazy person.
Love that you bring TikTok in like you're some hip new Gen Zer. I bring in Mario Kart like an old millennial.
I'm on the talk. I'm on the talk.
I don't know what it is about scripture projects, but it does bring people together. Here's what David Whitmer said of Rigdon and Smith at the time. Quote, "Rigdon was a thorough Bible scholar, a man of fine education, and a powerful orator. He soon worked himself deep into Brother Joseph's affections and had more influence over him than any other man living. He was Brother Joseph's private counselor and his most intimate friend and brother for some time after they met. Brother Joseph rejoiced, believing that the Lord had sent him to this great and mighty man, Sidney Rigdon, to help him in the work."
Boy, I certainly didn't sense any hints of jealousy there, did you, Lindsay? He worked himself into Brother Joseph's affections.
I mean, sorry, David Whitmer is out on the revelations. Games. He's not as interesting now. New man is in town.
You do kind of feel sad for David because the Whitmer family really had been there. I mean, they had housed him while they were doing the translation for part of it. And then the new kid comes on the block and he's cooler. And
you got to think, though, Joseph Smith, whichever way you take him, whether you take him as a fraud, whether you take him as divinely inspired, having a classically trained theologian like Sidney Rigdon, who's debating Alexander Campbell, you know, in this great enlightenment, had to have been not only great for his ego, but great for the brand of Mormonism in general.
Cowdery had definitely kicked it up a little bit. He was certainly a little better educated than Joseph Smith, but Rigdon, that was a totally different story. He definitely added some class to the organization. And the thing is Joseph Smith definitely had some influence on Rigdon also, but it went both ways. Just days after meeting Rigdon, Joseph Smith begins to be taken with the idea of communal living. So he heads to Kirtland in 1831 to meet the saints there. But since Rigdon had been gone, the new saints in Kirtland had gotten sort of a little rowdy, let's say.
I talked about this in Year of Polygamy on the episode about playing Indian. What happens is you leave these newly converted Mormons with a book of scripture about ancient Native Americans who need to be brought back to Jesus, and then you leave them in the hands of folks who are already really into spiritual gifts and a little bit hippie, and you don't give them any sort of manual or instruction or leadership, and things turn a little wacky.
Is this an ad for the church handbook so that we don't do this? Sounds like an ad for the handbook.
Correlation.
Here's a description of what Joseph and Sidney walk back into in Kirtland as reported by the Painesville Telegraph. This is February 1831, quote, "The saints would fail as without strength, roll upon the floor, and so mad were they that even the females were seen on a cold winter day, lying under the bare canopy of heaven, with no couch or pillow but the fleecy snow. At other times, they exhibited all the apish actions imaginable, making grimaces both horrid and ridiculous, creeping upon their hands and feet, etc. Sometimes in these exercises, the young men would rise and play before the people, going through all the Indian maneuvers of knocking down, scalping, ripping open, and taking out the bowels. At other times, they are taken with a fit of jabbering, after which they call speaking foreign languages by divine inspiration. At other times, they would start and run several furlongs, then get upon stumps and preach to imagined congregations, baptize ghosts." Close quote. And yes, you are right to note all sorts of racist overtones in how those behaviors were being described.
Honestly, it sounds like a word roadshow if you think about it. It's like, it's a little racist, it's a little wacky, it's a little spiritual. You got all of those combined.
It's a good commercial. Just a little bit racist. The wardrobe show.
You know, I used to be so mad that they got rid of those, but now I'm like, I think I get it.
Yeah, I was never mad they got rid of that. That sounds...
It was so fun. Like, not the racism. The racism wasn't fun, but the whole, like, creating a set in, you know, 24 hours...
And then see winning, previous comment.
Winning the 22nd ward. Do you hear that 22nd ward? We won because we were smarter and better and funnier.
I was the kid in the foyer that was so mad that my beautiful basketball court was being taken up by this nonsense. I just wanted to put some chairs away in the creepy hole under the stage. That's all I wanted.
Well, I mean, the racism was definitely fueled by the Book of Mormon. And this whole playing Indian thing was so insane when I first learned about it, that there were early Mormons doing all these kind of things. What isn't there an article or a book?
There is a fantastic book about this. Angela Pulley Hudson, really, really interesting. Werner McCary obviously is at the center of that story, but she puts all of it in context. This earlier stuff, very, very interesting. And it was a really strange time because you've got all of this fervor, all of this extremism, people are having visions, and it's just this charismatic soup of religious excitement, and they were loving it.
I really actually love this account by John Whitmer. He says, quote, "Some had visions and could not tell what they saw. Some would fancy to themselves that they had the sword of Laban." There it is again. It's always the sword of Laban. "And would wield it as expert as a light dragoon. Some would act like an Indian in the act of scalping. Some would slide or scoot on the floor with the rapidity of a serpent, which they termed sailing in the boat to the Lamanites. Preach the gospel, and many other vain and foolish maneuvers that are unassuming and unprofitable to mention. Thus the devil blinded the eyes of some good and honest disciples." And that's how Brian feels about roadshows.
And I would say the folks in the remnant movement, they're not really advocating this necessarily, but that excitement that the early Mormons felt.
And spiritual gifts.
Absolutely. Yep. This
I can see why it's compelling. You know, I've talk to a lot of remnant folks, and I'll be having dinner with them and get converted during that dinner and be like, this is amazing because it sounds so beautiful. But there's still a lot of racism, sexism, and homophobia in a lot of their fellowship. Sorry, guys. It's true.
That's why we should all be doing sacrament talks and lessons based on general conference talks. These are the ways of safety. All right, so we've already covered a lot of this early history in our Kirtland episodes. Smith and Rigdon team up, they turn the hippie commune in Kirtland into a Mormon commune, and then they start growing the religion together. It really is a team effort. Only, Joseph Smith wasn't super happy about the name Commonwealth Families or Common Stock. Smith's new communitarian vision would be called the Law of the Lord, which, is, by the way, is a totally different animal. Not at all the same.
Well, it doesn't sound as fun as the family. 12 Mormon elders got together in February of 1831 to start writing out a new plan for this communal order. As they tried to experiment with these new ideas, they were still growing. By that spring, they had over 1,000 people who had joined in Kirtland.
But all of this was a little too good to be true. As Richard Van Wagner notes, every generation goes through a phase. Mormons in their earliest days did these communitarian experiments and millenarian expectations, and that latter would definitely stick around longer. Van Wagner aptly describes how these failed hopes, quote, "stranded the saints in an Advent season, the 11th hour, which has endured for more than a century and a half." Such a great sentence. He also argues that this unrealized dream was one of the central reasons that Rigdon would finally grow disillusioned with Joseph Smith. Nancy Rigdon, however, would like a word about that.
know that the communal experiment in Kirtland didn't work out so well. Actually, things kept not working out so well for Mormons in general. In Kirtland, in Missouri and elsewhere, Mormons were growing in converts and in enemies. Failed revelations, discord in neighbors, threats of poverty all contributed to problems for the church. People like Ezra Booth, who had joined Mormonism and then disaffected, were out there sharing their experiences with Mormonism to the papers, and people were not impressed.
Meanwhile, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon were enraptured in heavenly ecstasy, having visions of a new heaven with 3 degrees of glory, which you, of course, know as Section 76 in the Doctrine and Covenants.
And I need to explain how these visions came about because it actually makes a case for Bryce Blankenengel's ethnogenic theory of Mormonism, which Brian doesn't believe, but I think there's a good case of. The men were now staying at the Johnson farmhouse, and here's how Philo Dibble describes the visions the men were having. Quote, "The visions, which is recorded in the Book of Doctrine and Covenants, was given at the house of Father Johnson in Hiram, Ohio, and during that time Joseph and Sidney were in the spirit and saw the heavens open. There were other men in the room, perhaps 12, among whom I was one. During a part of the time, probably 2/3 of the time, I saw the glory and felt the power, but did not see the visions. Joseph would at intervals say, 'What do I see?' As one might say while looking out the window and beholding what all in the room could not see. Then we would relate what he had seen or what he was looking at. Then Sidney replied, 'I see the same.'" I'm sorry, this sounds like a bunch of guys doing mushrooms. Dude, do you see that?
Dude, what do I see?
See the angel?
Dude, I see the same thing, bro.
Okay, that's the language, I will give you that. So yeah, Joseph asks what he sees, Sidney confirms, then Sidney would ask what he sees, and then Joseph confirms it. They do this while all of the other men in the room were just sitting there being spectators. Then, according to the Dibble account, quote, "Joseph sat firmly and calmly all the time in the midst of a magnificent glory, but Sidney sat limp and pale, apparently as limber as a rag, observing which, Joseph remarked smilingly, 'Sidney is not used to it as I am.'" Well, okay, now while some see entheogens behind this, I take a little less sexy path. I just see the two of them spitballing out loud.
So strange to think about now, just watching that. You're Philo Dibble.
Yeah. You're just sitting, hanging out. And I will also point out that this account is interesting because, of course, this is later. This is Utah. This is a Brighamite account. And not surprisingly, Joseph is amazing while Sidney is like, "Boy, this spirit stuff, this really wipes me out, man. I can't take it. I'm not ready for it."
He's just not like the prophet. That's why he can't handle the revelation.
Such an apostate.
How convenient. You wouldn't have Mormonism, though, as it exists today, in any form at all without Sidney Rigdon, so sorry, Brighamites, that's just the truth. He and Joseph revelated on the order of heaven, the plan of God, Lucifer being expelled from heaven, the degrees of glory, and so much more. Basically everything in Saturday's Warrior we get from Sidney Rigdon.
I think he's in the credits, like he's the historical consultant, right? Though early followers of these two men were happy with these new doctrinal upgrades, the sons of old Father Johnson were a little less pleased. They saw Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon as grifters that kept using their old gullible father for his property. This, of course, leads us to the infamous tar and feathering situation in March 1832.
You know this story if you're Mormon or if you're watching Under the Banner of Heaven and you're a historian and you're really mad about it. There's even a primary lesson written about it. Basically, here's the TLDR. Angry mobs drag a sleeping Joseph out of the home, and Sidney Rigdon is also dragged out nearby. They're tarred and feathered. Joseph's beautiful alabaster skin and glowing blue eyes, as played by Andrew Burnap, is threatened to be castrated, but in the end, they try to make him swallow acid and he breaks a tooth. And here's why historians are arguing about this, because motivations on the attack vary. So Fawn Brody erroneously stated that it was Father Johnson's son, Eli Johnson, who was pissed at Joseph for making advances on his teenage sister, Nancy. The trouble with that story is that Eli was actually Nancy's uncle, but still—
Are you kidding me? That's like the worst historical problem I've ever heard of.
It's all false.
It's so funny how triggering this one is to folks.
Oh my gosh.
She didn't have a brother named Eli?
Neither did Sidney Rigdon's dad, as we talked about in episode 1. People mess up brothers and uncles all the time.
Tar and feather Richard Van Wagner.
Too soon. But still, accounts vary that the Johnson boys were pissed at Smith for impropriety and pissed at the men in general for using their father. And there were also some angry Campbellites in the mob that didn't like Mormons, period. And I actually think that the Nancy story holds, and here's the defense for it in the show. it's not like Joseph didn't have problems with women, you know, like.
Has to start somewhere.
You know, when people are like, why did you use that story? It's debated. Well, it captures a lot of pretty true narratives in that story. And though some will say it's thoroughly debunked, it's not thoroughly debunked. Claire Barris has some great sources outside of Fawn Brody's mishap that links other accounts to the castration. And why a castration if they're just mad about money things?
But we're not really focusing on Joseph Smith's sins here tonight. The important part of the story for today is that they drag Sidney Rigdon out, and who apparently received a very severe head injury as a result. Joseph Smith describes visiting him a few days after the attack, quote, found him crazy and his head highly inflamed, for they had dragged him by his heels and those two so high from the ground that he could not raise his head from the rough frozen surface, which lacerated it exceedingly. And when he saw me, he called to his wife to bring him a razor. She asked him what he wanted of it, and he replied, to kill me. Sister Rigdon left the room, and he asked me to bring his razor. I asked what he wanted of it, and he replied he wanted to kill his wife and continued delirious some days. I'd say that's fairly serious.
Yeah, I think this tar and feathering scene is important not just because I want to defend my choices with Under the Banner of Heaven, but because it really screws Sidney up, like, forever. When Sidney Rigdon was 7 years old, he was already thrown from a horse and had suffered a severe concussion that was said to have altered his personality. But after this 1832 incident, many of Sidney Rigdon's contemporaries talk about how Sidney began to change. Some say he used to preach very rapidly and used to get tremendously excited so that he foamed at the mouth. He had wild mood swings and sometimes fell into a dark depression. So sad.
And this might explain why the first, always loyal, Sidney Rigdon started to act out a little against the Smiths. The first sign that Sidney Rigdon was a little off started shortly after they thought he had healed from his brain injury. One night, Rigdon was supposed to preach to a group of Mormons, but he showed up late. According to Lucy Mack and others who were there, when he finally arrives to preach, he looked a bit haunted and told everyone that the keys of the kingdom, the authority of Mormonism, had been taken from the earth. Naturally, people in the congregation were stunned and confused. This is Rigdon telling you this, obviously. Hiram Smith, who was at the meeting, went to fetch Joseph. Joseph had to return to the panicked congregation and assure everyone that Sidney was wrong. No, the keys of the church hadn't been lost, everything was okay, and Sidney Rigdon needed to repent.
During his repentance, his priesthood ordination or license was taken from him, and he spent a few weeks in bed having what most people at the time thought was a dance with the devil. He was in his room and people outside heard violent noises and went to find him being thrashed across the room and to the floor as if the devil was throwing him about. No one understood this was probably a reaction to, I don't know, traumatic brain injury, and instead attributed this to the devil teaching him a lesson for his apostasy, of course. Rigdon was eventually considered repentant and was reinstated to the priesthood.
Throughout the 1830s, Sidney Rigdon tried to help Joseph Smith build a new Jerusalem in Missouri, but every attempt failed. Sidney Rigdon was also a prominent leader in the also-failed Zion's Camp March, where about 200 Mormon men marched around the frontier as a show of power. Ultimately, it was becoming clear that plans for this beautiful, communal Zion weren't about to happen. This decade, too, was really the triumph of Sidney Rigdon's Mormon career. As Richard Van Wagner puts it, Rigdon enjoyed, quote, equal billing with Joseph Smith.
During that decade, Rigdon had formed and led several societies and organizations for the church, publishing documents, revelations, bringing in the temperance movement to Mormonism, revising scripture, preaching and establishing a school of the elders. There, Rigdon trained lay leadership fundamental skills like reading and writing, but also theology, ancient languages, and Christian history. Rigdon would establish the Kirtland School as well to teach the children and anyone else basic reading and writing. So if your ancestors could write down their testimonies, you can maybe thank Sidney Rigdon for that. This might seem like a small detail, but again, we are talking later about Sidney Rigdon's bid for power. And remember that many of the church's earliest members, from tiny children to adults and leaders, were being taught and instructed by this guy for hours and hours and hours. He was in a position of authority to them. Absolutely. They were trained in theology by him, and their religious worldviews were 100% shaped by him.
We're not supposed to do this, but that sure reminds me of Warren Jeffs.
Just taking over the school and
kind of he has a very large influence on an entire generation of how they think.
I would just like to point out that Brian was the one that brought in the Mormon Godwin's Law.
It's my turn.
Buchanan's Law. That's what we're going to call it. Whenever you bring in Warren Jeffs into a conversation about Mormonism, Buchanan's Law.
Fine.
Use it. You guys can use that on the TikTok.
Put it on Wikipedia somewhere. A little less deviant, we'll say, than Warren, however. So the School of the Prophets that Rigdon organizes teaches these leaders many things, including a 7-part series of lectures to train missionaries that are going out. Remember that Rigdon had this trained theological background and was the perfect person to do this. So he's now literally training this whole generation of future Mormon leaders the fundamental basics of Mormon theology. These lectures, of course, you know them as the Lectures on Faith, remained a very important part of Mormon cosmology until 1921, when the LDS Church removed it from the Doctrine and Covenants, much to Bruce R. McConkie's disgust. Many fundamentalists and lots of other Mormon branches still consider these lectures an important part of their canon.
And they often misattribute them to Joseph Smith, correct?
Yeah, I mean, we don't for sure know that it's Rigdon, but it sure seems like it. The language, the concepts, they all really seem to point to Rigdon.
Could it be both?
I'm sure Joseph Smith had some influence on it, sure. But yeah, if you had to pick the one guy that's the driving force behind them,
the guy with the traumatic brain injury.
The guy with the traumatic brain injury.
So Rigdon not only did lectures on faith, he also helped publish the Doctrine and Covenants, revised the Book of Commandments, and published important theological essays in the Mormon newspaper in Kirtland, The Messenger and Advocate, because of course he did. He had to write, this is a little kid burning bark by the fire. It was in his nature. He also helped ordain many early leaders. And now we're going to take a small detour. We keep talking about Richard Van Wagner, Sidney Rigdon's biographer. Well, I have a little treat for you. Just like we did with the Mission to Hawaii episode, we're going to pull from the Sunstone Archives to give you some good info.
That's right. We've got Richard Van Wagner, one of modern Mormonism's most prolific historians, presenting about Rigdon at Sunstone in 1996. We're going to play a clip of Van Wagner as he shares another interesting doctrinal invention of Rigdon, women and the priesthood. Now, Richard does have an interesting presenting style, like Dale Morgan.
So bless his name.
Richard Van Wagner was deaf. So as you listen, that will help you understand more about his presentation style. It's pretty fantastic.
Aside from his obsession with establishing Zion, the most intriguing element of Sidney Rigdon's post-1845 religious career was his bestowal of priesthood on women. The concept of a female priesthood did not originate with him, however. In an 1868 statement, Rigdon asserted that Joseph Smith brought to light the glorious and queenly female priesthood. He claimed that Emma Smith was the one to whom the female priesthood was first given. Thus, Rigdon's action was based on his perceived view of Smith's precedent. On the 30th of March, 1842, 2 weeks after organizing the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo, Joseph Smith announced to the women that the society should move according to the ancient priesthood, and that he was going to make of the society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. 1 month later, in a 28th of April, 1842 lecture, the prophet again addressed this issue. According to his personal account, he gave a lecture on the priesthood, showing how the sisters would come in possession of the privileges and blessings and gifts of the priesthood, and that the signs should follow them, such as healing the sick, casting out devils, etc., that they might attain unto these blessings. The Endowment Coram, or Holy Order, was the vehicle through which Smith conferred priesthood on women. On the 28th of September, 1843, in an upper room of his home, the Nauvoo Mansion, the prophet set in motion the promised kingdom of priests by administering the washing, anointing, and priesthood endowment to Emma. At this same meeting, the Smiths became the first couple to receive the second anointing or fullness of the priesthood, when each was anointed and ordained to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood to become gods in this life. Following Smith's example, Rigdon, 20 years later, ordained his wife Phoebe to the priesthood. thereafter referring to her as the prophetess. The precise date of this bestowal, likely late 1863 or early 1864, is not known. The earliest existing reference is a 25th of January 1864 revelation directed to follower Abraham Bardas. The pronouncement praised Phoebe as having more faith than any other living woman. Speaking jointly of Phoebe and her husband, the communication added, "I thus place at the head of Zion a perfect priesthood. Let not Zion arrogate to themselves the right or power to deal with them," meaning the Rigdons, "for I alone have the charge of them." Sidney himself revealed in October 1864 the circumstances surrounding Phoebe's ordination. At a time, years gone, he spoke as God's mouthpiece, when alone and in exile, and thick darkness shrouded the Rigdons and their temporal necessities, pressing them heavily. "I, the Lord, said to my servant Sidney, take my handmaiden Phoebe alone and ordain her to the prophetic office before me. I, the Lord, was present and sanctified the ordination, as is this day manifest to all Zion." The earliest known evidence of Phoebe exercising her prophetic calling is her 10th of March, 1864 revelation warning Rigdon spokesman Stephen Post of pride. In compensation for Phoebe's long travail and poverty, Sidney worked incessantly during the final decade of his life to highlight her accomplishments. His accolades were effusive and diverse, but none depicted his true feelings better than a 23rd of October, 1871 tribute advanced in God's name. "But what shall I say of, and to my handmaiden Phoebe, the light of the world, the Lord's lamp in Zion, the firstborn daughter of the holy priesthood, who alone first taught me the true knowledge of the righteousness of Zion. There is no glory in heaven too great for her to possess. She is the firstborn of women. There were none like her before her day, and there will be none after equal to her." Although none were ordained by him personally, because he never visited his congregation in Attica, Iowa, several other women were inducted into the Rigdonite Elect Sisterhood, or Holy Order of the Female Department. The first was Sarah Newton, who still lived in Philadelphia at the time. In an October 1864 letter to her husband Joseph, a member of the ruling operative priesthood, or first presidency, Rigdon instructed him to ordain mine handmaiden Sarah before me to the office of a prophetess in Zion, to send forth, when I, the Lord, require the voice of blessing and of warning to the priesthood of Zion, and through them to all the children of Zion. Father Rigdon, in a revelation directed to Sarah Newton, then pronounced what must have been a surprising news to the happily married woman. "I, the Lord, dissolved all old covenants by which thou wast bound, that thou mightest be wholly mine, for I, the Lord thy God, art thy husband, to the exclusion of all others, that thou mightest do my will and stand before me thyself, that I, the Lord, might organize a quorum of female prophets for the benefit of Zion. It is my will, saith the Lord, that the quorum should be free from all earthly authorities, that I, the Lord, might be their ruler without men or the sons of men having any claim to them by virtue of the Gentile covenant." Newton, starting revelation, furthermore explained that, "My servant John the Revelator saw in his great vision a woman clothed upon with the sun, the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head, thus signifying that all the authorities of Zion should give heed to her own voice. The quorum of female prophets, which I, the Lord, am preparing, was what the women in the vision represented. John saw the woman that she brought into the world a man-child who was caught up into heaven. This man-child was to rule the world with a rod of iron, or the word of God. Verily, saith the Lord, this man-child is Zion, which is now preparing for his rule in his strength." This revelation to Sarah Newton specified equality between the sexes. "Behold, saith the Lord, this order is in accordance with the faith and prayers of your father Adam before me, for he has the same respect for his daughters that he had for his sons. And it was his prayer that when the celestial order of the Ancient of Days was established, that his daughters should have a voice in that council." Phoebe Riggin and Sarah Newton were soon advanced from the quorum of prophetesses to the operative or ruling priesthood. Thus, the first presidency of the Children of Zion was established, consisting of the Rigdons, the Newtons, and Stephen Post, whose wife Jane was not baptized until the 30th of April, 1865. In a February 1867 directive entitled "The Word of the Lord to the Quorum of the First Presidency of His Kingdom as Called and Organized for the Fulfillment of the Covenants Made to the House of Israel," the Children of Zion were instructed that these five members of the First Presidency were chosen before the world began. "I, the Lord," began the revelation, "having called and chosen you out of all the world to order an age and establish my kingdom for the salvation of Israel, had done so according to the covenant made with their fathers." A significant difference between the manner in which Rigdon and Joseph Smith bestowed priesthood on women was that at least 10 Rigdonite women, including Sarah Newton, Jane Post, Susanna Myers, Mary Hughes, Hannah Jones, Nancy Jacks, Louisa Sellers, Arabella Allen, Mary Metcalf, and Rachel Clark, were ordained elders as well as prophetesses. Smith never ordained women to specific priesthood offices himself. Although no evidence indicates that Sidney ordained Phoebe to any position other than prophetess, the Children of Zion revered her as the elect lady.
One of his most flamboyant achievements was the Kirtland Temple. He and Smith drew up the designs based on their New Jerusalem. And this is probably why, during the dedication of the temple, Sidney Rigdon goes to the stand and delivered a powerful 2.5-hour dedicatory sermon. It kind of sounds hella boring, but apparently it was very engaging. And if you remember, sermon culture at this time, they were used to these long sermons. I mean, this is what they did. This was definitely not out of the ordinary. And people that talked about that experience spoke about how eloquent he was at that. He got everybody really fired up. Remember, this is the high water mark of the Kirtland era. Then he introduces Joseph Smith, presenting him to the church as their prophet and seer.
You know, I've been to both, and I have to say, I really enjoy the architecture and the aesthetic of a Rigdon Smith temple over a Smith Young temple. Just more interesting, old school. It used to be blue on the outside. And even though they were having a good time there, these were high times, and there was plenty of low times too. Not only was Sidney still having pretty extreme mood swings, things were about to take a sour turn in Kirtland. Both Rigdon and Smith were co-equals in the Kirtland Safety Society fiasco. Both names were written across most of those disastrous documents. The Kirtland banking fiasco, which we've discussed in other episodes, nearly brought the church to its knees, and Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon were equally yoked there.
We've got a $5 Kirtland Safety Society note right now at Benchmark, and it's just fun to look at that and realize that's history. These guys touched that. Enter Brigham Young. He noticed Sidney Rigdon's inability to handle finances, and so he begins blaming all of this in Kirtland on Rigdon. Very convenient. Of course, in Kirtland, the whole thing causes a very potent leadership crisis, and Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon barely escape with a thread of confidence for some of their followers.
Also, it didn't help that the Whitmers, including key early guy David Whitmer, remember him, and John Whitmer? They've been sort of shuffled off to the back burner. John Whitmer was the official church historian. These guys start their own church during all of this, taking advantage of the confidence crisis, but then they're narrowly pushed out of authority, making Rigdon and Smith the new official church historians. So both Rigdon and Smith don't really handle criticism well. Rigdon would fly into rages disguised as sermons, chastising and accusing people of disloyalty.
Joseph Smith, who didn't have a traumatic brain injury to blame his behavior on, didn't react well either. John Whitmer records that the First Presidency got together to discuss what they're going to do with these dissidents, and Joseph Smith said, quote, "Any person who said a word against the heads of the church should be driven over these prairies as a chased deer by a pack of hounds." Nothing ominous about that.
Very pastoral. I like Richard's assessment, quote, "Putting teeth into the rhetoric, a clandestine army of Israel was formed from the organizational remnant of Zion's camp. bound together by Machiavellian artifice into brotherly union, members swore fraternal oaths to, quote, always uphold the First Presidency, right or wrong, and to assist in the utter destruction of the apostate. Enter the Danites, or Daughter of Zion, Brother of Gideon, the Thresher, the Big Fan, the Son of Dan, Ziggy and the Spiders, whatever you want to call them.
And then, of course, if things weren't already tense enough, Rigdon gives his famous July 4th speech. This is 1838. He gets up on the stand and delivers this to Mormons after a Danite parade. This sermon declared war against outsiders, and Mormons were now above the law and would respond with violence. This, not surprisingly, was a very popular speech for the Mormons in attendance, but did not play so well to, I don't know, the rest of the world.
This, of course, led to further conflict in Missouri. I know you're surprised about that. Leading critics of Rigdon's, like Brigham Young and Jedediah Grant, two really friendly, calm, gentle men, Wilford Woodruff and Orson Hyde, to say that Rigdon had gone too far and it was his fault that they had to flee Missouri. I don't know, they might have been right this time. This time, just once, Brigham Young was right.
As the church fled to Missouri and eventually Nauvoo, the chaos in the church, coupled with Joseph Smith's legal troubles, added to Sidney Rigdon's troubles. During the Nauvoo period, his health was pretty poor, either from malaria, like a lot of folks there, or some pre-existing issues. He went through a long, terrible period of depression.
It's not too big of an exaggeration to say that Rigdon slept through most of the Nauvoo period. His poor health prevented him from being too involved in anything. He was well enough to deliver the keynote address on April 6, 1841, when the Nauvoo Temple cornerstones were laid, but the entire day exhausted him. People that were there remarked on how gaunt and weak he looked.
His health wasn't the only thing on the decline in Nauvoo. So was his friendship with his best pal, Joseph Smith. We talked about his daughter, Nancy Rigdon, before, but let's give you a brief refresher.
Sidney Rigdon's health promises were growing even slower than Joseph Smith's eternal family. Remember, it's the Nauvoo period, and Smith is starting to go on, let's call it a marrying spree, a sealing spree. It doesn't take too long until Sidney Rigdon finds out that Joseph Smith had approached his teenage daughter, Nancy. I actually hate everything about this story so much.
So Nancy goes and tells her dad, your friend just tried to get me to marry him secretly. He's 17 years older than me, and he's married, and I have a boyfriend named Francis Higbee, and he will someday start the Nauvoo Expositor with his buddies because of this nonsense. Okay, maybe not the last part. She still knew it with every fiber of her being, though.
So Sidney finds this out. He demands an audience with Joseph Smith, who at first tries to deny it. Nancy doesn't even budge, and I actually love this. She holds her ground, and it's pretty baller. Joseph is like, it didn't happen, it didn't happen. Nancy has the letter, now called the Happiness Letter, as further proof that, and she stared Joseph Smith down and was like, you lie, and you know it, and I know it. And then Joseph was like, okay, fine. I was just testing her to see if she was like virtuous or not. It was a test and you guys, she passed. It's cool. But Sidney wasn't having any of it.
Can we all agree that it was just a test routine? Can we all agree that the it was just a test routine really sucked? I mean, sure, yes, this life is the test. We're not going to argue with Janice Cap Perry here. But come on, this is the same thing he did with Heber and Valet Kimball. Don't worry, kids, I was just testing you. Eventually, Joseph Smith admits he was after it and then tried to explain this new doctrine to them. Sidney Rigdon was, let's say, not pleased. Ben Wagner notes that Sidney now had evidence that Joseph Smith was indeed involved in the spiritual wife business, and he, even the prophet Joseph, had, quote, contracted a whoring spirit.
Even though the men lived but two rods from each other, they stopped being friends for a while. And I can never remember how much is two rods again.
I think it's spare the rod and spoil the child.
Supposed to cling to one. Okay, so not helpful. At the same time, Smith was facing more and more rumors of, you guessed it, spiritual wifery. Sidney was ill and tried unsuccessfully to run for Illinois Senate, because why not throw that on top of everything else on his plate? So it's really a busy time, and the men just sort of avoided each other in perfect Mormon passive-aggressive style. But Joseph Smith's records show that he and Sidney were having real difficulties and that there was trouble between them.
The men would have several clandestine meetings where Sidney Rigdon begged Joseph Smith to stop slandering his family in public. Joseph Smith finally agrees, but then a few days later, he denounces Rigdon by name. Joseph Smith's strategy was to try and align John C. Bennett with Rigdon. Rigdon needed a bumper sticker that said, "Never get messed up with a Babes in Toyland villain."
Van Wagner has this money quote about this. Listen up, quote, John C. Bennett kicked open the prophet's bedroom door, exposing his foibles publicly. In Orthodox Mormon circles, Bennett was a scabby opportunist who tried to camouflage his own sexual adventures. Yet much of what Bennett wrote about Mormonism's inner circles was factual.
Joseph Smith says at this meeting that, quote, any man that would suffer John C. Bennett to come into their houses was just as bad as he. Joseph Smith then lobs Nancy's character onto John C. Bennett, saying that Nancy is one of your shady ladies. I'm guessing that's not going to help the Francis Higbee situation that's brewing.
So, now the High Council is trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Is their beloved leader, Sidney Rigdon, a problem, or is Joseph the problem? Who is the bigger problem? The Nauvoo newspaper, The Wasp, decided to print an article in the form of a petition talking about how Joseph Smith was a man of good character, and Sidney Rigdon refused to sign it, along with Orson Pratt and Rigdon's in-law, George W. Robinson. And by now, several women, along with Nancy, were telling a similar story. Joseph had approached them, and when they refused, he slandered them.
And these women, Nancy Rigdon, Sarah Pratt, Martha Brotherton, had to hitch up their petticoats and get ready as they, quote, saw their reputations impugned by an avalanche of slander. As you probably recall, it got super ugly. Joseph Smith called Sarah Pratt a whore from her mother's breast. Martha Brotherton was a mean harlot. And Nancy Rigdon was simply a poor, miserable girl out of the very slough of prostitution. That's going to get a yikes squared from us. However, as Van Wagner points out, despite all this ugliness, none of these women, Rigdon, Pratt, or Brotherton, had anything to gain from sticking to their guns. Quote, none had obvious political motives to hurt him. There is no fame to be had in all of this unless you have a getting called a whore in public kink, I guess.
Yep, and this was just the beginning of the end of Joseph and Sidney's friendship. Also, I know the Joseph fought polygamy folks like to say I cherry-pick history. But Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young hated each other. Wouldn't it make more sense to blame Brigham for all this nonsense if you're Sidney Rigdon? What do you have to gain to accuse him of this if you're super sick and weak, trying to stay out of trouble and not wanting to piss off Joseph? Which was usually always Sidney's attitude. He didn't want trouble.
Or, you know, you could blame John C. Bennett for everything. I think at this point, everybody in Nauvoo would see that Bennett is going to be the scapegoat for all of this. Accusing Joseph Smith for all this makes absolutely no sense strategically unless he did exactly what Nancy Rigdon said he did. Rigdon eventually tried to change the winds against his family by playing nice. He goes to a meeting and bears his testimony of the truthfulness of Mormonism. He says he never labeled Joseph Smith as a fallen prophet. Then he goes to the Wasp, saying that Nancy never gave John C. Bennett permission to publish the letter. This distanced him publicly from Bennett, but it wasn't really a denial of the Rigdon story either. And unfortunately, Nancy's reputation just kept getting worse.
Affidavits start flying back and forth about Nancy's virtue. Now remember, she's a very young girl at this point. Man, it would have sucked to be a woman in the 19th century where your sexual reputation and purity would be argued back and forth like that. I'm so glad it's not like that now.
Oh, we've come so far.
But at this point, Sidney's stunt with the Wasp really didn't patch things up between him and Smith. Smith had become increasingly paranoid about those around him, especially Rigdon. Rigdon had been postmaster, which paid well. Smith tried to oust Rigdon and George W. Robinson from their positions over the mail. Likely because he wanted to monitor letters coming in and out from apostates like John C. Bennett, Francis Higbee, and George W. Robinson. When he couldn't get the job under his control, he began spreading rumors that the Rigdon family regularly plundered the mail and misused it.
Emma Smith then gets drafted to join the fun. She sent a letter to Sidney Rigdon chastising him for mishandling the mail against her family, accusing Sidney of perhaps opening letters not addressed to him, that kind of thing. And that led to a whole debate where Rigdon's family had to, again, defend themselves against allegations they were mishandling the mail. Letters and more affidavits go back and forth in the paper. It was very ugly.
Meanwhile, Babes in Toyland villain John C. Bennett wrote Rigdon a letter trying to get him and Pratt to help expose Smith. But Rigdon wasn't having Bennett shenanigans either. He gave the letter to Pratt, who turned it into Joseph Smith. Loyalty was worth many points to Joseph. Except...
Joseph Smith decides to use this as an opportunity to prove that Bennett and Rigdon were in cahoots. Backfired. Joseph Smith as John Taylor issue an article in the paper showing Bennett's letter and vocalizing that this letter was proof that Rigdon wasn't to be trusted because he and Bennett were friends. Sheesh. This back and forth continues for a time, with Rigdon even playing nice in the First Presidency for the sake of looking unified. But then, Smith got arrested in Naboo, and he blamed Rigdon for conspiring to bring him down. There's actually a really fun back and forth in the pages of that old commie pinko rag, Sunstone. It's between Ed Kimball and Sam Taylor, of all people, debating the relationship between Sidney and Joseph during this period.
As we get closer to the end of Joseph Smith's life in this chronology, remember that Joseph Smith starts sending all of the apostles on missions. Rigdon was called to Pittsburgh, and in the meantime, he and Smith were involved in an interesting dance of love and hate. Smith even held a church court to determine if Rigdon really had been part of an effort to collude with the government and get him arrested. They ultimately found Rigdon to not be traitorous beyond return, and the pair gives it a go yet again.
And of course, this is part of Joseph Smith's candidacy for president, and he selects Rigdon as his running mate. Even though they didn't really trust each other at this point, I think this thing shows that Joseph Smith understood that Rigdon was seen by many in Nauvoo as the co-organizer and a stakeholder in Mormonism. And for his part, Rigdon realized if he resists Joseph Smith, his prospects for himself and his family are going to be grim. So the two kind of needed each other, even though all was definitely not all whorehound and roses around there. And I always kind of find it funny when people point to this as evidence that Joseph and Sidney were pals again. I don't know how to break this to you, but being on the same ticket definitely is not proof that you are BFFs. See the John McCain, Sarah Palin campaign, or consult the Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson rule for this discussion.
In reading about this time period, I was really struck by this strange realization that Sidney Rigdon was, to his death, adamant that the Second Coming would arrive. I often wondered what beliefs about the Second Coming, the end of the world, would do that for people. But if you think about it, at least in Rigdon's case, he was so fragile. His world was already always nearly coming to an end. I can't help but wonder that the need to believe in apocalypse and the end of days is really just part of the human instinct that the world will end for all of us someday. We all die. It will all be over eventually, and I wonder if that belief taps into the anxiety every human feels about their own death. Because I think it certainly came into play that way for Sidney Rigdon.
Speaking of mortality and endings, Joseph Smith continues to deal with other dissent in the ranks. The Nauvoo Expositor happens, and then Joseph Smith's killed. We've talked about this. And remember, all of this happens while Rigdon is off in Pittsburgh, stumping not only for the prophet, but for himself. He had to be in a different state to establish residency, since the president and vice president candidates couldn't live in the same state per the Constitution.
So when news of the martyrdom arrives in Pittsburgh, Sidney Rigdon naturally thinks he's going to be the next one to take over. Naturally. It makes sense if you're Sidney Rigdon. He mentions this to Jedediah Grant, who brought the news of Smith's death, that he, Rigdon, was ready to take up the prophetic mantle and, quote, now take his place at the head of the church in spite of men or devils at the risk of his life, end quote.
And this is another thing that occurred to me as we were doing this, is at this point particularly, LDS Mormons really see Sidney Rigdon as this schemer at this point, this juncture of it. But remember, all of these sources are Brighamite sources. Jedediah Grant, Brigham's guy. So when he's talking about how Sidney Rigdon responds to this, there's probably a good chance it wasn't really like that.
And what's wrong with Sidney thinking he's going to be the next guy? I mean, he built up the church hand in hand. He was the one that was signing those Kirtland notes and getting tarred and feathered with Joseph. Not you, Jedediah Grant.
It was pretty natural. But you know what? Get this, Sidney. You're not the only one thinking you're going to be the next in line. Brigham Young and others who are perfectly accepting of the polygamy doctrine were immediately setting out to thwart any political moves that Rigdon would try to make to become the next leader of the church.
It's kind of sad to realize that while Rigdon was at home in bed in Nauvoo, his Mormonism and Joseph's Mormonism had diverged so completely. The rest of the apostles were doing their own thing, having their own conversations, coming up with their own doctrines and ideas, while Rigdon was too sick to do any of that. And this would not play out in Rigdon's favor.
And this is where we're going to leave you with Rigdon for now. Rigdon, returning from Pittsburgh, would have many surprises in store for him. Grab for power was underway before he even sets foot in Nauvoo. O is for other, P is for people, scratch temple. The last P, well, that's for the Books of Mormon report. By the 1990s, Richard Van Wagner was a very accomplished author. He had published a collection of short biographical sketches on some colorful folks called Book of Mormons, and a fantastic book-length study entitled Mormon Polygamy. In addition, he'd written a bunch of groundbreaking articles. Then in 1994, he publishes the biography we've talked about tonight, Sidney Rigdon, A Portrait of Religious Excess. This won Best Book Awards from both MHA and John Whitmer. It's classic Richard. Great research, except for the Bush Declaration, which we will forgive him for, and straightforward prose. It's a very no-nonsense approach to history. I think you've seen how interesting Rigdon is, and it very much is a great biography.
Blood, oh brother Young, and let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young, cause I sin so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young, I sin so gravely, brother Young, let all
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.